say at the outset, I am absolutely mathematically challenged, and there are no equations in this talk at all. So what I'm going to talk about is principles of developmental biology. And I have sort of an ulterior motive for doing this. The way I constructed these things was the way that I think a nice, slim textbook for undergraduate students ought to be constructed, so that they can actually read it in one semester instead of having to plow through the 700 or 800 page textbooks which are currently available. Okay, so development is also called ontogeny. This is actually the real technical term for this. And that's defined as the process by which the species-specific form of an individual organism is built in each succeeding generation. And this can be done by an asexual process, for example, budding of a hydra. Can be a sexual process, which is what most vertebrates use, or can be a combination of both, alternation of generation in the life cycle. Our mechanistic concept of ontogeny is a mixture of two very ancient ideas, one called preformation and one called epigenesis. They actually go back to the time of Aristotle. Preformation was the idea that said that every succeeding generation of a particular organism is folded up inside the preceding one. And development is merely a matter then of growth. So this would be a series of Chinese boxes going back to the original organism itself. The other was epigenesis, which said that first the substance out of which the embryo was formed was actually formless, and then a force of some kind shaped that substance into the body of the embryo. And Aristotle actually tested out these two ideas. He made holes in incubated chicken embryos, and he was able to see that the parts of the chick embryo actually were formed in a series of steps. But that idea didn't catch on in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. Then preformation was king, and you actually saw drawings of sperm with a little homunculus crunched up inside, and inside that homunculus would be another one, and another one, and another one, and so on and so forth. Finally, in the 18th century, Caspar Friedrich Wolff put the idea of preformation, that kind of preformation, predelineated form, to rest, and showed that in a series of experiments on chick embryos that epigenesis was actually the way embryos developed. Now, in modern times, the two ideas have come back together again, because we are preformed in the blueprint of the DNA, and then that code is read out by an epigenetic system to give us the form of the embryo. So this is kind of amazing. These two old ideas have survived for over 2,000 years. This sentence. So what this really says in the modern version, is the only way to get from the genotype to the phenotype is through ontogeny. We use that genotype to get the phenotype.
That ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny?
No, ontogeny creates phylogeny in reality. It doesn't recapitulate it. Yes?
Can I just ask, for everybody making notes, these slides, will they be online again like we've had before?
Sure.
If we get them, we put them on. We take schedule of the workshop and we attach them.
Yeah. I'll certainly turn mine in.
Sure thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what are the approaches to the study of ontogeny? Well, there are basically three. One of them is anatomical, where you just observe the changes in form that go on during development. One is experimental, where you actually interfere in some way with the developmental process and then look at what the outcome of that interference is. The third is genetic, where you can make mutants that affect different developmental processes, but it turns out these approaches are never used as singular things. What we do is a combination of the three. Research models, just about anything, that develops as a research model, but here are seven that have been used very extensively. Mollusks, worms, fruit flies, zebrafish, frogs and salamanders, chickens and mice, and they each have different advantages and disadvantages. You study mollusks if you want to study the effect how determinants actually in the cytoplasm specify different parts of the embryo. Worms are good, planaria, they regenerate very well, for example, and there's a nice, very nice program of regeneration at the University of Utah going on right now by Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado using RNAi, which is a method to interfere with the activity of genes to dissect what kinds of genes are involved in the regeneration of planaria. Fruit flies, everything we know about human developmental genetics comes right from fruit flies. What amazes me is that sometimes you put in a grant proposal and it's on, let's say, amphibians, and they say, well, we don't understand what relevance amphibians have to humans. And so, well, the fruit fly is, you know, way back, considerably further than the amphibians, but what we've learned in studying fruit flies is that the genes that control development are conserved across vast phylogenetic differences, even down to mollusks themselves, and lower than that. Frogs and salamanders or zebrafish are great because they're a vertebrate that you can make a lot of mutants in. They're called the Drosophila of the vertebrate world. And the difficulty with them, though, is actually doing surgical operations to change the spatial relationships between tissues. That's tough, but that problem with technology is being overcome. Frogs and salamanders have great big eggs, so they're easy to operate on right from the start, and then the embryos are large, so a lot of tissue transplantation has been done there. You have to collect these or either breed them in the laboratory. Chickens have the advantage, you can get them off farms, and you can do the same kinds of operations. And the mouse, of course, has a tremendous genetics. This is a mammal that's the closest to us for experimental purposes, and there are just lots and lots of mutations in mice that affect development. Okay. What are the fundamental processes of ontogeny? I think there are three. The first one is differentiation, that's cell specialization. And secondly, there is patterning, that is the spatial organization of differentiation that defines the boundaries of developmental domains. And then there's morphogenesis, which is the actual shaping of the tissues and the organs that give you the form of and these are all related to one another. They're reciprocally related. Differentiation affects patterning. Patterning controls differentiation. Then the same thing between differentiation and morphogenesis, and patterning and morphogenesis. So these three things are going on simultaneously at the level of the cell. What kinds of cell specializations do we see throughout the course of development? Well, different cell types give off different signals, and they have different receptors. There are different internal proteins. For example, a muscle cell has actin and myosin that's organized as interdigitated strands. Cell junctions, the junctions that hold cells together, are different in epithelia and in mesenchyme. The extracellular matrix composition is different. A bone will have a very hard matrix composed of hydroxyapatite and organic material, mainly collagen 1, whereas connective tissue will have a very different extracellular matrix composition. Adhesion, cells sticking to substrates, that differs between different kinds of cells. Cell shape, obviously, differs from one tissue type to another. The ability of cells to move differs from one cell type to another and at different stages of embryonic development. Motility, by the way, is a prime aspect of developmental biology. Cells have to be able to move in order to get into the correct locations in a lot of cases. Polarity, cells have polarity. Epithelial cells, which line a lumen, such as in the intestine, are polarized, so that one end has one function and the other end has another function. Energy production, chondrocytes, cartilage cells, don't use much energy because they're stuck inside these little caves inside an extracellular matrix, whereas muscle, on the other hand, and neurons use tremendous amounts of energy. Their electrical properties, neurons can conduct electrical impulses very well, cartilage does not. And then there's positional information, which we'll hear more about later. Cells in different parts of the developing embryo, they know their location, and they know that their location is different from cells in another part of the embryo. Okay, so here are the principles that I've come up with for ontogeny, and I would be grateful to all of you if you see ways these things can be combined. I have 8 of them. I'd kind of like to get them down to 7 for some reason. 7 always seems lucky somehow. But, any suggestions about these principles, modifications of them, would be greatly appreciated. Well, here's principle 1. Differentiation is the result of differential activity of equivalent genomes. And here's the, I'm going to just show some proof of this. This is an experiment by Hans Spemann in Germany from 1938. We all hear today about somatic cell nuclear transfer. It was Hans Spemann who actually started this in vertebrates with an extraordinary clever experiment on a salamander egg.
Are you
going to
explain what somatic cell nuclear transfer is?
Oh, sure. Sorry. It's taking a nucleus from, like, say, a skin cell and putting it to, this is the modern version, and putting it into an egg that has had the nucleus taken out of it. Now, that the nucleus of the egg is what we call haploid. It only has one set of chromosomes, but the nucleus taken from the somatic cell has the normal diploid number. And transferring that nucleus actually mimics the act of fertilization, and that egg will then start developing with that donor nucleus. The big advantage of this in medical terms today is that if we could do this with a human egg, it hasn't been accomplished yet, you could raise those eggs to the so-called blastocyst stage, about 5 days of development, when the little ball of cells that actually forms the human embryo is present at one pole, and those cells can be cultured as embryonic stem cells, and they could be transplanted back into the nuclear donor without fear of being immunorejected. That's the big medical use for these things these days, although the potential medical use, I should say, because it's not really being
done. Would that egg be a clone then?
Yeah, yes,
it would be a clone.
Yeah, if you let it go to term, that would be a clone. Mm-hmm. So here's what Spemann did. I always marvel at how clever these old embryologists were. Took a salamander egg and he took a baby hair and he tied it around the egg, and made a ligature. And this ligature separated the egg into two halves. One half contained the nucleus, the other half did not. So this is all cytoplasm. This was the half with the nucleus. The half with the nucleus began to divide. And at about the 64 cell stage, the ratio of nucleus to cytoplasm gets smaller and smaller as time goes on. This nucleus was of the size where it could actually slip across the ligature into the other half of the egg. So this had undergone now 8 divisions. And what he was really asking here is, when the nucleus divides, does it lose something that is responsible for cell differentiation later on? So this nucleus had divided as a result of 8 divisions, and it slips across into the undivided half, and that half then begins to divide. The result was twins, showing that at least up to 8 cell divisions, these nuclei all have equivalent genomes. Okay? And then these wonderful experiments from the 1950s by Briggs and King and John Gurdon in the 1960s, again using somatic cell nuclear transplantation to show that genomes are equivalent even at late stages of development. So what they did was to take an intestinal cell from a tadpole of a frog, and then they transplanted that into an enucleated frog egg. They let that develop into a stage called the blastula, which has about 10,000 cells. And then they took nuclei from those blastula cells and serially transferred them into other eggs. And in the course of this experiment, you know, some of these survived as normal tadpoles and some were absolutely abnormal. But of the survivors, what they got was clones. Here were the parent frogs of the nuclear donor, and they're albinos. This is the wild type donor of the enucleated egg. So they were putting the nucleus from the albino frogs into the enucleated egg of the wild type, and got this clone of albino frogs, because of course the development is controlled by the nuclear donor. So there are your clones. That's, if you could imagine doing this to human beings, this would get the same thing.
Question.
Yes?
You always hear about how hard it is to clone.
Sorry?
You always hear about how hard it is to clone.
Yeah.
So why did this work, and why is it so hard now?
Well, it was probably no less difficult then than it is now, because these results, you have to do a lot of these nuclear transfers in order to get results. So in mammals, it is more difficult in mammals. It's technically more difficult because you're working with a much smaller egg. This is a large egg. So in mammals, it's quite difficult. And it's less than 3%, I believe, of tries in animals. Dolly the sheep took 200, can't remember the exact number, but something like 210 tries to get one sheep. So it's not a very efficient process at all. Yes?
It seems like you're looking for a rare occurrence of, I mean, on average, what happens when you do this process?
On average?
Sorry.
It's a small percentage. Just a small percentage will give rise.
That's right.
So
he's asking what happens to the other ones.
Right.
Oh, what happens to the other ones? They die. Yeah, they're not successful at all. But you understand what is happening is this nucleus is coming from a differentiated cell, and it has to be reprogrammed now to be essentially an egg nucleus, a fertilized egg nucleus, and that is very, very difficult, it turns out, because although the genome is the same, there have been a lot of changes to that genome that make it difficult to start dividing as if it were a fertilized egg nucleus.
But is it difficult to incompetence, or is it difficult to stochastic? Because if it's stochastic, then we've got mathematics. If it's incompetence, we've got some biologists that don't know what we're
doing.
I would say, well, if by incompetence you mean, do we know all the factors that lead to this? Yes, the biologists are incompetent. Yeah. But if you accept the fact that they do the best they can with what they know, then it's stochastic.
Yeah, but the point is, at these small scales, we've already talked about stochastic events, which are deterministic or non-deterministic. And so now there are actual physical processes that do have different outcomes, even if you give the same conditions.
Yes.
So that's the point, is it stochastic?
I would say that in these cases, yes. I mean, it's just stochastic to me in this situation. Do we get lucky?
Okay, but you're very confident.
The people who do the transplants are good microsurgeons. Yes?
Do you have to think that differentiated egg all the time, or could be independent?
The egg?
The nucleus.
Well, what they want to do, they want to take it from, no, you can take it from a very early stage, and then the success rate is much higher. Because the nuclei haven't been tampered with by the process of development yet. But what they were after was to say, all right, does the nucleus of a fully differentiated cell still have a complete genome? Okay? And the successes that they had indicate that, yes, those cells do have a complete genome.
So is it intestinal cells is difficult? I mean, they could have picked a different cell, maybe a nerve cell.
Yes, and they've done it on several cells. Intestine was one, because they can see, they can actually see when they take the cells out of the intestine that they are fully differentiated. But they've also done them on epithelial cells in skin and maybe a couple of other cells.
But I guess my question is, are all cells equally differentiated, or some more difficult to clone with?
Well, so far, the limited sampling suggests that, yeah, they're all equally difficult to clone.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, every cell in the body is differentiated to some degree, with the perhaps the exception of the germ cells. Okay, here's something that's very interesting that I have actually become aware of only in the past few weeks. And that is this thing called an epigenetic code. We know the code of the genome, the sequence of the bases. But this epigenetic code is something different, and it may actually determine the patterns of gene transcription. The genome itself has been referred to as the hardware of the cell, and this epigenetic code has been referred to as the software of the cell. This is what happens to the DNA of cells as they differentiate. They get the DNA itself gets methylated. Methyl groups get put on cytosine bases of the DNA, and that process silences those genes, shuts them off, so that they're not operating. Every cell, you see, is using a different battery of genes. So this epigenetic code is going to presumably would be different for each differentiating cell type, and that methylation shuts off genes. The second component of this code are these little bodies right here called nucleosomes. And if you look at a high-power electron micrograph of chromatin that's extended out, you'll see that the DNA is wrapped around these balls of protein. And those balls of protein, those are nucleosomes, and they're composed of histones, proteins called histones. The histones have tails that stick out from them, and those tails can be methylated, they can be acetylated, and they can be phosphorylated. In other words, modified by these three different processes in combinations of those. And sometimes those modifications of the histone tails lead to activation of genes, and sometimes, depending on the combination, it leads to silencing of those genes. The really interesting thing is that this is heritable. I mean, we think of inheritance as being strictly through the DNA, but this epigenetic code appears to be heritable as well. Twins, for example, is a very good example of this. Twins have absolutely identical genomes, as far as we know. But as they develop, and also later on in life, they are differentially susceptible to different kinds of diseases. So these twins, in the end, are not identical. Their genome is identical, and their phenotype may be identical, but they have one may be more susceptible to intestinal cancer than the other. One may be more susceptible to getting asthma than another. And it is believed that the reason for this lies in differences in this software, this epigenetic.
But what are the differences in the software come on?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer.
Same question, the histones and everything that you see on this picture, this is all coded
Yeah. You wonder if there's a hidden code in the genome. Maybe it's like the Da Vinci Code. or whether this coding happens, you know, the genome makes the messenger RNAs for these proteins, but or for the enzymes that actually do the methylation, acetylation, and so forth. But there's some other kind of process going on that determines what these patterns of methylation, acetylation, et cetera, are.
So when you take a differentiated cell and stick it into an egg, does some demethylization occur?
Yes, absolutely. Right. That's what I was going to say next. That's how this connects up to the problem of getting these clones, because this methylation pattern, acetylation pattern, et cetera, that has to be reversed so that this epigenetic code is what exists in the fertilized egg. Yeah.
So the histone acetylases, aren't they in the nucleus or they're in the actual?
Yes, they're in the nucleus.
So
yeah.
If you transfer an intestinal cell, for example, so that contains the software, the acetylases specific
mm-hmm.
for the intestines.
Yeah.
How come you can overcome those set of acetylases when you put it into a?
Well, that the egg cytoplasm is the fountain of youth. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but obviously being in that egg cytoplasm can do this, because the egg cytoplasm will have its own epigenetic code that could override, at least in a few cases, this one. Yeah.
So from a mathematician's perspective, what is it fair to say that in the differentiated cell that the combination of the nucleus and the cytoplasm have reached some stable equilibrium point from which it does not normally escape. But if you pull that nucleus out and put it into a fresh cytoplasm, then it all gets fixed. That is, whatever had happened to it, at least there's some positive probability that there's enough stuff in the cytoplasm to get it out of that stable equilibrium it's stuck in and back to its...
Put it into a new one. A lower level, yeah. Also, cancers could arise by environmental insults to the epigenetic code, and that code is now being viewed as a potential target for anti-cancer drugs.
But also environmental toxins. So maybe if you have organics that actually methylate or demethylate individual genes within cells that are duplicated organs, then the twin who is exposed to that would have a different way of expressing those genes.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Yes?
It seems remarkable that there would be a biological mechanism for this process. I mean, it's hard to imagine that from an evolutionary point of view that you would be able to demethylate. I mean, that seems to say something very deep about evolution or the cells. I mean, that they could have this process somehow built in. Do you think it would
maybe this is a mechanism that is involved in actual evolution, heritable changes.
Well, I mean, those cells have to do that to make germ cells anyway. I mean,
Absolutely, they do, but that's another mystery. I'm going to talk about those germ cells a little later on. And you know how do germ cells remain germ cells throughout development? Sure.
But the most fundamental thing, now that you get on your talker, is the most fundamental thing is chemistry. Because like you said, and it was very prescient to say methylation, phosphorylation, acylation. These are chemical events that are now used throughout all of biology. Like you said, activation. Well, we need to understand what that is. And the methylation prevents this transcription factor from really
that's
doing
right.
its job.
Yeah.
So that's where the engineering and the materials and the engineering chemistry come in. I think this is awesome.
Yeah.
And your stochasticity.
Yes.
And your stochasticity.
Our
stochasticity. And confidence. Okay. Second principle. Localized maternal factors specify the axes of the body plan during oogenesis and fertilization. And these localized maternal factors, I'll say at the outset, that could involve an epigenetic code as well. So here's the general concept. This is just the idea. Is you have first an unfertilized egg, and you have different maternal factors or determinants that become localized in different areas of that egg. And I've got it pictured here as red, blue, green, and yellow being localized in the different quadrants of the limb. Now, eggs follow certain patterns of cleavage that are specific for a species. So here shows two cleavages resulting in four cells. And those cleavage patterns happen to separate those four quadrants of this hypothetical egg. And now the blue determinants, the red determinants, the green determinants, and the yellow determinants are segregated into different cells of this embryo. And so you see the general idea there. Okay, so Dr. Meinhardt will talk more about this next, about specification of axes in embryos. But I choose the frog here to illustrate because I like frogs. That's what I've worked on. So how does a frog egg start out? It starts out like this. Here's the structure. There's a so-called animal hemisphere that's heavily pigmented, indicated by the black. And this pole, the center of that, is called the animal pole. These two little things here are polar bodies that have been given off during the process of egg formation. And you've all seen frog eggs in the water. The dark side is up. The reason all that pigment is there, it protects the frog eggs from UV light. Okay, so this axis drawn from the animal pole to the opposite side, which is called the vegetal pole, it pretty much corresponds to the head to tail or anterior posterior axis of the embryo. And then everything else is radially symmetrical around that egg. But there is localization of maternal determinants in this egg, and here's one called VegT, messenger RNA, beta-catenin, which is a molecule that helps form transcription factors. These are all localized down in the vegetal part of this egg cytoplasm. And of course, the bottom half is filled with yolk. That's another difference. So there's a very distinct difference between animal and the vegetal halves of this egg, with everything being radially symmetrical around that animal vegetal axis. Yeah.
So how do you localize presumably small protein molecules made here?
Yes, it's done on microtubule tracks. Microtubules are proteins that can polymerize to form long tracks, and molecular motors then move these molecules along these tracks. And the next question is, okay, how do the microtubule tracks and the motors get organized? I give up.
Chicken and egg problem.
Okay. Frog. Yes.
This axis depends on the type of
item
rather gravity.
Yeah. I think there was an experiment that was sent up on one of the Gemini mission a long time ago, but I can't remember I do remember what happened. There was a handle that had to be plunged on the container to fertilize the eggs, I think it was. And the handle broke and the experiment, and there never was an outcome of the experiment. But what my expectation would be would be that these things probably would develop normally, because you can reorient these eggs and you can still come out with normal development on Earth.
I think actually the frog experiment, if you don't have normal gravity, the cell size during cleavage is different.
Is it?
But it depends. Frogs are special because mammals don't care about gravity.
Right.
In the end.
Yes.
But I'm trying to remember who did the experiments, but there have been moves in the embryo.
But in the end, that doesn't make any difference.
No.
to the development. So these can regulate quite easily. Okay, well, here's the equator of this egg. And here shows fertilization. Now, the sperm enters on one side of the egg. And it turns out that
Does it always go in the animal hemisphere?
Yes, it usually does go into the animal hemisphere. Yeah. So
does it know how it knows?
I don't know. Maybe via receptors on the surface here. That would be the most likely idea. So anyway, the side that the sperm enters becomes the ventral side of the animal. Fertilization, what I'm saying is fertilization specifies the second axis, the dorso-ventral axis. We have the anterior-posterior axis here. Now we have to get a dorso-ventral axis back to belly, and it's fertilization that accomplishes that. So the side of sperm entry becomes the ventral side, and the opposite side becomes the dorsal side of the egg. Now, what happens during this this time? When the sperm hits and starts traveling toward the center of the egg, this cytoplasm right underneath the plasma membrane of the egg, it's called the cortical cytoplasm, undergoes a 30-degree upward rotation on one side, the side opposite the sperm. So now we have these determinants, or some of these determinants, moving upward on this side of the egg, the side that will become the dorsal side. So beta-catenin, for example, the beta-catenin stabilizing agent and some other things here all move up to this side on microtubule tracks. During the course of that, the animal vegetal axis is tilted 30 degrees. So this will now be the actual anterior, posterior, head-to-tail axis of the embryo, and this will be the back side, or dorsal side of the embryo. This will be the belly, the ventral side. We'll hear more about this kind of thing in the next talk. Okay, so those are these maternal determinants then help form these two body axes, anterior, posterior, dorsal, ventral. So the third principle, the structure of the basic body plan is set up during cleavage of the egg by interactions between modules of cells that received different maternal factors. So as the egg cleaves, those localized maternal factors are going to be segregated into different cells. So I've just made a little summary slide here. Here's the unfertilized egg with these localizations in the bottom part, anterior, posterior. There is no dorsal or ventral at this point. Then fertilization, and now we get a dorsal-ventral axis because some of these get moved up on this side of the egg. Now, what's new here in this slide is that this forms an area right here that actually instructs the cells just above it to become a third type of cell. At this point, we have two types of cells, ectoderm and endoderm, here and here. But this interaction of these cells with these maternal components now determines that there will be a third cell type, and that's the mesoderm. These are called the germ layers. There are three of them. The ectoderm becomes the skin and the nervous system of the embryo. The mesoderm will become the musculoskeletal and blood system, blood vascular system, and the endoderm will become the digestive system of the embryo. So triploblastic, that's, we're all made like that too, with three layers of tissue. Okay, so now that sets off once the mesoderm is formed, that the dorsal side of that mesoderm, this side right here, has very special properties. It's called the organizer. sounds like, you know, the mafia, okay? But this side tells everything else basically what to do. It organizes all the tissue structure along the dorsal ventral axis and along the anterior posterior axis too.
It may be worth saying, I was waiting to see if you'd show the picture, but you're not going to show it. But I was up at Santa Barbara on Friday, and Bill Smith there has done some beautiful experiments in Prague, where he's shown the textbook picture of the organizer and the fate maps of the different maternal areas are wrong.
Really?
That,
okay.
It's really wrong, really badly wrong.
I will talk about this. And I will show what is the root.
But it's worth, if you ever look in a textbook, it'll say this is where the blood primordia comes from.
Yes.
This is where so and so and so and so. If you look in a basic textbook like Gilbert,
yes,
and you see that picture, put a big X through it and look up what's been done experimentally in the past 5 years.
All
because
right.
it's totally wrong. It's seriously wrong.
Is there an organizer?
The organizer does not do what you think it does. It does. It is important.
Okay.
But it maintains rather than induces structures.
Are you referring to the neural?
Well, you're.
Yeah, I'll talk about that. That's true. It does.
Well, but anyway, I don't want to be the one to keep you from.
Okay, so
it's an interesting result.
New fake
new
maps.
Result.
Then.
Yes, new fake maps.
Okay. So anyway, this triggers off these so-called morphogenetic movements of gastrulation. That's the stage of development. And what essentially happens, we can
what is gastrulation?
Just this is where the three layers now become concentric with one another. In that previous slide, they're all still on the surface of the embryo. The embryo has a big cavity in it, and everything's on the surface. But now, since everything's concentric in the fully developed body, this is the stage at which that concentricity is attained. And it's attained by these movements of this dorsal side, dorsal mesoderm of the embryo. This dorsal mesoderm tucks under a specific spot, and that's called the blastopore, the dorsal lip of the blastopore. And you have to imagine this is one section, but this is going, this spreads from that dorsal spot all the way around the embryo. So it's a sheet that's a mass of cells that's moving in. And so it tucks under and goes the opposite direction up toward the anterior end of the embryo, and this shows a later stage of that, and this big mass of yolk is just being pushed ahead of this, and finally we have this prospective mesodermal region now underlying both the dorsal midline of the embryo, where the central nervous system will form, and it also goes out of the screen and into the screen toward the ventral side. This closes the blastopore around, and you can see that here. These arrows indicate the movement. And here's the yolk plug stage, as this is called. Now, these morphogenetic movements are very, very complex. And one of my former graduate students, Ray Keller, who's at the University of Virginia, is a guy who's mapped out and studied a lot of these different kinds of movements. I don't think on the molecular level it's very well understood yet exactly what drives these things. But what Ray has found is that there are several kinds of cell movements that are involved with the interning and forward movement of this mesoderm. And by the way, as these disappear from the surface and are moved inside, this ectodermal half has to spread out to cover the area that's been vacated by those two tissues. So these are the kinds of movements. If you look at this one, here's a tissue that's three cells deep, and that can, by intercalation upward, radial intercalation, this will spread and become two cells deep. And here's another one. This is three cells deep again. This shows that three cells deep becoming one cell deep by intercalation. Other movements, cells intercalating medially, that will cause a reduction in the volume of a tissue and extend it at the cross-sectional volume, and it will extend it lengthwise at the same time. That is called convergent extension. That happens on the dorsal midline of that inwardly moving mesoderm. Okay, principle four. Organ fields within the basic body plan are established by cascades of interactions between cellular modules. And here's this organizer experiment that was done by Hilde Mongold in 1924. Yes. The idea, here's that dorsal side. This is where the cells will move inward to establish the middle or mesodermal layer of the embryo. And what she did was to graft that particular site to the ventral side of another embryo. This is a classic experiment after removing this chunk of tissue. Now she gets a secondary gastrulation occurring on that side. This tissue begins to move inward along with the normal tissue moving inward here. And a second embryo forms on the ventral side of the donor. This is a cross section of the grafted. Here's the graft. What that's produced. This is actually neural tissue. Here, the section shows the secondary embryo with a secondary neural tube, nervous system, notochord, and blocks of mesoderm that are going to form the muscles and the vertebrae of the embryo. And the finished product looks like this. Siamese twins. So that's where this idea came from, that as this mesoderm moves in from this dorsal region, what it's doing is sending out inductive signals to the ectoderm that overlies it, and those inductive signals determine that this overlying ectoderm will become central nervous system. So it was kind of surprising. Everybody thought this was an instruction. It was sort of surprising in the mid-1990s that it was found out that what actually happens is that the whole ectoderm is sort of in a neural default state. And proteins called bone morphogenetic proteins are responsible for inducing most of this as skin ectoderm. But what's happening here is that there are antagonists to the bone morphogenetic proteins being produced by this mesoderm that ensure that this overlying ectoderm remains in the neural default state and goes on to make a central nervous system. So here's this longitudinal section. Here's the neural central nervous tissue here overlying this dorsal mesoderm, which will become the notochord, which is sort of a precursor to the vertebral column. And again, these are morphogenetic movements that are involved in neurulation. At first, this neural ectoderm is a plate, and then that plate folds up. Here are the apex of the folds moving toward the midline, and eventually they approach one another, they converge, they fuse, and right here are two strips of tissue called the neural crest that sort of that epithelium breaks up on either side of the midline. The neural crest then goes on to form a number of structures, some of them neural, spinal ganglia for one, and others, other kinds of things like pigment cells. And this neural tube then separates from the overlying ectoderm, which becomes epidermis, and the and goes on to differentiate the different parts of the central nervous system, brain, spinal cord, etc. The fifth principle is that boundaries of organ fields specify the organization of pattern within. And the limb is probably one of these that's been studied most. This is a developing limb bud in the chick. And presumably, according to recent experiments, all the different parts of the fully developed limb are present at this particular stage, and then they grow. But in my talk on Friday on regeneration, I'm going to propose that this epidermis, ectoderm, is a distal boundary for this particular organ field, and intercalation takes place within it and the proximal boundary. One of the reasons that this ectoderm has been given so much attention is that it's thickened in the embryo into what's called the apical ectodermal ridge. There is a posterior signaling center called the zone of polarizing activity that emits a sonic hedgehog protein signal. There's a feedback loop here. This AER maintains through fibroblast growth factors, the ZPA, and the ZPA in turn maintains the AER. If you remove the apical ectodermal ridge from this limb bud, and here this is a normal limb bud showing a humerus, radius and ulna, and a wing, and then three digits, typical chicken wing. If you remove that early on, then you get very truncated limb parts. It turns out that the reason that the parts are truncated is because the cells at the distal tip die. So the AER produces something that allows those cells to survive. Sixth principle, developmental mechanisms operate during adult life to regenerate and reproduce. Regeneration takes place in three ways. Here's one. It's called compensatory hyperplasia. That's when a cell can superimpose a cell cycle protein program onto its differentiated state. And the best example of this is the liver. This just shows the structure of the liver, trabecular, so-called plates of hepatocytes that are interspersed with sinusoids lined by epithelial cells. And so here we have a graph. This is from a paper by George Michalopoulos in Science. It just shows the kinetics of proliferation of hepatocytes different kinds of cells in the liver. So here are the hepatocytes. They're the ones that divide first, and they divide the most. Then there are other cells that kick in at different times afterwards, and it all goes like
what's
that.
What's hepatectomy on the
axis? Surgical removal of a mass of the liver.
Okay, so they took out some cells and they're watching them come back?
They actually go in, this has been done mainly in rats, and they go in and they resect two-thirds of the liver.
Okay.
One-third is left, and that's the hepatocytes in that one-third proliferate to restore the mass that was resected.
Okay, and then how do they see the different cells? I mean, how do they know the different types?
You can feed them labels like bromodeoxyuridine, which gets incorporated into the DNA, and that will give you a measure of the cell division.
They're simply looking at them because they're quite different morphologically.
Sorry?
You can look at them.
Oh.
Histologically. And
oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Wait, so they go in at certain times and take out some of the new cells
at
and
intervals.
Look and see what,
yes, that's
what kind they look like.
Sure. You have a lot of rats that are regenerating. So, yeah. So they get these mitotic profiles for all the different cell types of the liver. Skeletal muscle regenerates by a different route. It's by stem cells. In fact, most of the regeneration in adult bodies is by stem cells. And this shows just a single muscle fiber in vitro, and the arrows here are pointing to cells that lie outside The plasma membrane of the muscle cell, these are so-called satellite cells because of their position. And when this fiber is injured, these are the cells that are activated, they proliferate, and they repeat the process of muscle development, which is to have cells proliferate, line up in tandem, and fuse, and then differentiate the contractile apparatus of the muscle. This is an electron micrograph of a satellite cell. Here's the plasma membrane of the muscle cell. This is a basement membrane that overlies the satellite cell. And this is another satellite cell. This is from a newt. There's another way to produce stem cells, and the amphibians do this. This is to create stem cells by the dedifferentiation of mature cells. So these animals I call the divas of dedifferentiation. This shows the limb. They regenerate their limbs as well as a variety of other structures very well. This was an amputation through the radius, distal end of the radius and ulna. It's a longitudinal section that's been stained with dyes. And this is 4 days after amputation, showing a bunch of cells with very darkly staining and very active nuclei, both in DNA synthesis and RNA synthesis, underneath this wound epidermis that has formed over the tip of the limb. Now, if that were a human limb, this would develop into scar tissue, and that'd be it. But not these guys. These cells proliferate, and they give rise to this large conical structure called the regeneration blastema. Then at about 9 or 10 days after the amputation, in these particular larvae, that mass of cells starts to redifferentiate. And so here you can see the outlines of new cartilage condensations forming, and this is the end result. You have an exact copy of what was amputated. Yeah.
Yeah, I read somewhere that we traded in an ability to regenerate limbs for a more advanced immune system.
That's certainly an idea that is worthy of exploring. So we have this thing called Center for Regenerative Biology and Medicine that's got people from Indianapolis, Bloomington, and Terre Haute in it. And two of the people in Bloomington are pursuing this kind of thing.
So the inability to form scar tissue is really the influence of a weaker or less advanced immune system in this organism, but
yeah. But that's the correlation. I'm not convinced, though, that because that this is the cause of the ability to regenerate or lack of ability to regenerate. I think this is something that's certainly worth exploring. It's not a new idea. It's been around for some years. But we're going to have to wait and see if this is actually true, because there are too many instances of exceptions where we can regenerate the tips of our fingers too. We have a very advanced immune system. Yes?
Can you explain how big can they de-differentiate themselves? How can they de-differentiate? How do they do that?
Well, it's a long, involved story, but just to be very superficial about it, what happens is the extracellular matrix around these cells is dissolved by acid hydrolases, matrix metalloproteinases, and if there's any bone there, the matrix is broken down by osteoclasts. And so the cells are liberated, and what I think happens, although this certainly isn't proven, change in shape that the cells undergo when they're liberated changes the organization of their cytoskeleton. That leads to changes in gene activity that give you these mesenchymal-like stem cells.
Is it known that there are changes in methylation and acetylation in the DNA?
No,
that
it is not known.
Is that been studied?
It isn't known, and it would be an excellent avenue to pursue. Yeah.
So are there genetic perturbations that would prevent limb regeneration but not interfere with normal development?
In nature, the only one that I know of in salamanders is a mutation called short toes. Now, short toes allows the embryo to develop into a larval axolotl, okay? but that animal has defects in the kidneys, and so they eventually die. But that mutation does prevent regeneration after amputation.
Is there any correlation between the ability to regenerate and ease of cloning?
No. In fact, there is an old paper where, in fact, there are two old papers where nuclei from these dedifferentiated cells were inserted into enucleated eggs with very little success. So it may be that these cells maintain those methylation patterns and throughout the course of regeneration. Although you've got to think that some things are different, because it's well known that these dedifferentiated cells that come from the connective tissue out here form cartilage. They switch their phenotype to cartilage a lot of. Any other? Okay, this is the reproduction part. It's very interesting how animals form the stem cells that are going to make the gametes of the body, the male and female gametes. So this is Drosophila. And what Drosophila does, Drosophila has maternal factors on the posterior end of the embryo that are incorporated in the cells there, and those cells, which are called pole cells, they're the primordial germ cells, and they become the gametes. So it's all done by maternal factors there. Same for these frog eggs here. This is that vegetal pole that I showed you, the bottom of the egg. That frogs, too, develop their germ cells by these specialized maternal determinants in this polar cytoplasm. So this region of this egg and this egg are destined right from the very beginning to become germ cells. Now, what those factors are, what's in there that makes those eggs have the whole, that cytoplasm have the whole program for development, I can't tell you. I don't think any of us know at this point. This is a mammalian embryo, mouse embryo. And this is stained for a transcription factor called OCT4. OCT4 is a transcription factor that's characteristic of embryonic stem cells. This is the inner cell mass of the early mouse embryo. And if human embryos look very similar, that's what we all come from, is this little ball of 13 to 25 cells. And they're expressing OCT4 like crazy. That OCT4 is necessary for their pluripotency, that is, their ability to turn into virtually every cell type in the body. This is a later stage of development of a mouse embryo stained in a different way. And here are the primordial germ cells. These are not formed by cytoplasmic localizations like the frog and Drosophila. They're formed by cell interactions that go on during development. So, there they are. This is the germinal ridge, and these are the cells that will develop in the sperm or spermatogonia, which are the adult stem cells of the mouse, and oogonia of the male mouse, and oogonia, the adult stem cells of the female mouse. And the same would be true for humans. And these are just some pictures of, this is oocyte development. These, how we get the adult stem cells, the female adult stem cells, they start like this. They're these primordial follicles, ovarian follicles, and then the purple part is the actual oocyte. It's surrounded by a number of couple kinds of support cells. The oocyte grows until finally it's mature, and then in the mature female, mammalian female, that is then ovulated on a periodic cycle. And here's the situation, the adult stem cells for spermatogonia. These are contained in seminiferous tubules, and they start with, these are the earliest stages, these are the adult stem cells themselves, the spermatogonia, and these spermatogonia differentiate from the wall of the seminal tubule out toward the lumen of the tubule, where they become full-fledged spermatozoa. So reproduction then is via adult stem cells, just like regeneration, but these are very special adult stem cells in that they can give you a complete organism, whereas these other adult stem cells cannot. Principle 7, the environment regulates some aspects of ontogeny through the epigenetic code. We know about these environmental factors. Gravity is one. We all exist under 1G on this Earth. Tension, muscles pull on bones. And in fact, joints. You can't develop joints during embryonic development unless you have muscular activity. You have to have tension on the bones. So these are mechanical, physical kinds of things. Developmental symbiosis. Some organisms will not develop unless they are living in a symbiotic relationship with another organism. Larval settlement in the ocean particularly. Larvae of animals like various kinds of sea squirts, et cetera, they have to come to rest on rocks. But if that rock isn't the right type, they can't do it. And so they're getting signals from these various substrates that very specifically tell them where to sit down. And then there's something called polyphenism, where the embryo will take on a different phenotype depending on what the environmental conditions are, and that's what I want to show here. This is Daphnia, this is a rotifer, barnacle, a bryozoan, a mollusk, and the fish, the carp. And what you see here is the typical form of these organisms, these adult organisms. Now, this is the form that the organism takes when in the presence of predators. This is an incredibly interesting kind of thing. The numbers here give the survival, the percentage survival of the typical form versus the survival of the form that's adopted in the presence of predators. Look how the forms change. This is the so-called helmet of the Daphnia. It gets a lot bigger. The rotifer becomes.
Question? Yeah. Your survival numbers are with the predator around, right?
This one is without the predator. That's the typical form. Okay.
Okay. So if
this is the form that's adopted in the presence of the predator, and that number indicates the number that survived.
But the survival. So. The 40%, even when there aren't predators around, they only survive 40% of the time.
Right. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's not right. That's in the presence of the predator in each case. Okay. Yeah. So these are the forms that they take on in the presence of the predator. The rotifer looks like it's developed bat wings. And the barnacle changes its shape from this flattened form to this rounder form. The bryozoan gets these things like spikes sticking off the top of it.
I have a kind of silly question. There are different predators for each organism, right?
Oh, yes, sure.
It's not.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's not man.
No, it's not man. Not in this case. And the mollusk, you notice this, how empty this opening here is to the shell, now develops this tooth. And the carp gets much bigger, bloated and hunched. So the survival goes up when in the presence of these predators, when this form is taken on. The basic concept here is these things are much harder to eat with that change. Yeah,
they're much
harder to eat.
So without the predator's presence, do the numbers reverse themselves?
Don't know. That's the only set of numbers I've got.
Oh, so without predators present, are there still the predator-induced morphs?
No. These forms, you only see them in the presence of predators. And not every member of the population takes on that form. The ones that don't get eaten.
I apologize, but we probably should hold questions till the break. We've that, but we want to have as much conversation as possible, but we better let you get through your number eight at least.
Okay, I'll do this fairly fast. This one I've actually seen in operation up in ponds in central Pennsylvania in the summer. These are frogs. This is what happens when ponds start to dry out. And what you see is this mass of wriggling tadpoles in these drying out ponds. This morph emerges under those circumstances. It's a much bigger tadpole. It has big jaws with big jaw muscles. And its intestine is modified compared to this one. Notice how small the jaw muscles are here. This animal is an omnivore. It eats brine shrimp, algae, and this is a carnivore. It eats its fellows. They don't have that morph. So that is a polyphenism that's induced by environmental change. The last principle, heritable developmental changes are responsible for evolution. And I don't need to show the slides for this. This will be intuitively, I think, fairly obvious. But descent with modification is the primary evolutionary principle. And there's a set of genes that determines the development of the different regions of the body along the anterior-posterior axis. They're called the HOX genes. And there are four sets of these things. They're involved in anterior-posterior development, also some mainly anterior-posterior development, but in limbs, also in proximal distal development. These HOX genes are very highly conserved, so you can look at them in Drosophila, and you'll see many of the same ones that you see in the mammalian embryo, and they all have essentially the same task, but they've been, the time that they're turned on and the length of time that they're active determines that the body plans of the mammal and the fly will be different. There's developmental modularity, heterochrony, and allometry. Heterochrony is the earlier development of one part of the body compared to other parts of the body. I will show one example of that. And then there are developmental constraints, physical, morphogenetic, and phyletic. And the rule is, development is probably what drives evolution. If there is a change in the developmental program that does not fit in with the existing program, it will never be selected for. But if there is a change that leads to better functioning of the animal and that actually fits into the existing developmental program, that can be selected for. And probably that happened very early on, millions of years ago. Today, the creationists are always telling us, well, show us a change in speciation. The reason you probably can't is because all of these different forms have been set up to the point where most of the changes in the developmental program are going to lead to death of the embryo. So you're going to see very slow evolution now, if at all. But at one period of time, there was a tremendous explosion of evolution. And I suspect that that was due to fewer developmental constraints. Let me just show one more slide. That's the HOX genes. This is heterochrony. This is a sand lizard embryo and a chicken embryo versus two mammalian embryos, roe deer and the spectral tarsier. Notice the eyes, the size of the eyes. The eyes begin growing very early on in development in these two species compared to these two species. And when these animals are born or hatched, they have very large eyes. And of course, birds, we know, depend on their vision much more than they do on a sense of smell or anything else. And these two mammals, look at ourselves, we have very small eyes in proportion to the rest of the body compared to a bird. Okay, I don't think there's anything else there. So that's that.